The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since Time magazine profiled Pacific Palisades class of 1965 that spring, this class has become metaphoric in personifying the radical social and political changes of the 1960s. Those graduates grew up in one world and entered a very different one. But the world of Pacific Palisades is completely different than, say, the world of Americus, Georgia, in the southwestern part of that state, on the front lines of the civil rights struggle. Former Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter and editor Jim Ockmoody tells a story of that class of 65 and one student who believed in racial equality and nonviolence. For Greg Whitcamper, high school was an ordeal, a trial by fire, if you will, where at best he was shunned, but more often verbally abused, physically assaulted, and attacked. When he crossed the graduation stage in the spring of 1965, he was openly booed and chased from the school afterwards for having the gall to bring a black friend to the ceremony. But one student that night did acknowledge his trial, and 40 years later, it would open the door to atonement, forgiveness, and redemption. The story is recounted in The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Jim Ockmoody is my guest today. Jim Ockmoody, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm very pleased to be on.
You know, when you talk about the class of 65, it's sort of become a metaphor in many ways because there was another book years ago that referred to whatever happened to the class of 65, and it sort of become a metaphor for a generation that grew up in one world, and within a year or two, they found themselves living in a completely different world. Your class of 65 really tells a far more personal story, but it's that same journey. Greg Whitcamper, who... you write about his worst years of his life, which is his high school days. Why were they so bad?
Well, it was a combination of what was going on in the country at the time and the particulars of where he grew up. He grew up in Sumter County, Georgia, in southwest Georgia. It's a county that's known as the home of Jimmy Carter. Plains, Georgia is there. It's also where the Andersonville prison camp was, where 13,000 Union prisoners died during the Civil War. So it has an amazing history there that sort of speaks of the New South and the Old South. Greg grew up at a very unusual religious community there called Koinonia. It was a religious farming commune, a Christian farming commune, a few miles outside of Americus, and it was founded in the 1940s on the principles of racial brotherhood, communal living, and nonviolence. All three of those made it very suspicious in the eyes of the locals because they regarded it as communist. The nonviolence thing didn't go over very well during the Cold War. And, of course, the racial thing was like an insult to the local segregationist ways. Greg grew up at this commune, and they were very well known for being supporters of the civil rights movement. And he was, by definition, he was a member of the enemy camp, and he was going to be mistreated in high school because of where he came from and because of what they believed.
And you recount a high school, literally a high school career in which he was pretty much virtually shunned for three of his 4 years of high school. He left for 1 year and went to school in North Dakota in another religious community. But for the 3 years he was at America's High School, he was at best shunned, if not physically and verbally confronted, nearly every day.
Well, all of the students who went to this high school from this farm, there were a handful of them, all of the Koinonia kids were mistreated. Greg was certainly mistreated from the first time he walked in the school there in the fall of 1961. Part of the reason was it coincided with the coming of the Civil Rights Movement to southwest Georgia. That was the fall that all the mass protests started in Albany, Georgia, which was just down the road from the farm. So he was mistreated the whole time. His particular torment was really worse because in the fall of 1964, the year that America's High School was forced to admit four black students, Greg was the only child from Koinonia at the school, the only one. And there was a great deal of resentment and anger that fall in America's over the passage of the Civil Rights Bill earlier that year, over the fact that their school was being desegregated. And Greg, being the only person from Koinonia, he took the brunt of the punishment because they considered him a traitor to his race.
And in fact, he actively courted that because he actually accompanied those black students on their first day of school.
Greg knew all the black students who were desegregating the school. He had been in civil rights protests with them. Koinonia was very involved in the civil rights movement in Albany and then in Americus when it spread to some other towns in southwest Georgia. So he knew them. When he found out that the high school was going to be admitting some black students, he wanted to show his solidarity with them. And he found out that three of the four black students who were going to be going to class at the beginning of the school year that fall, riding in a black funeral home limousine. A funeral home limousine supplied by the largest black funeral home in the town. Greg volunteered to ride with them. So it was actually the second day of classes when everybody sort of figured out what was going on. He rode to school with these black students. This limousine pulls up at the school. There's a mob of 50 or 75 people there. It's the Little Rock scene. They're throwing rocks. They're screaming ugly words. A couple of them threw bottles. And this limousine pulls up, and the door opens up, and the first person out of it is not one of these black students, but it's this white kid from Koinonia. And so all of the feelings that were already running against Greg just intensified.
And Greg subscribed to the philosophy of the community. He never fought back. He was attacked on several occasions. In fact, in one occasion, he was challenged to a fight. He always figured that the kid didn't really want to fight him, but eventually he threw a punch at him. And instead of retaliating, he basically dropped his hands and said, "I love you." I mean, this kid was so amazing in his views of nonviolence. And he was making an impression. He didn't know it at the time, though.
Well, let me tell you the kind of stuff he went through, particularly in the fall of 1964 when things were at their worst. His locker was urinated in. His school books were trashed all the time. You know, people hit him with paper clips and spitballs. They called him all sorts of ugly names that we wouldn't want to repeat on the radio. He was hit several times that fall. None of the girls would talk to him. When he would walk down the hall, people would literally turn their back on him. He was just like persona non grata. And the incident you're talking about, which was really, it's a passion play, really. In fact, I devote an entire chapter to this one confrontation. One of the people on the football team, a guy named Thomas, accused Greg of calling him a bad name in class and said, "I'm going to meet you after school and beat you up." And Greg didn't think too much more about it. He thought it was just a threat. People had been telling him for 3 years they were going to beat him up. Well, when he left school on this day, he was walking by the old baseball grandstand they have there. A group of about four dozen or more boys stepped out and blocked his way, and they would not let him go. They circled him, and this guy Thomas walked up to him and challenged him to a fight, and Greg said he wasn't going to hit him back, and Thomas just hit him right in the face, right in the cheek with a haymaker, staggered him. And Greg was so committed to nonviolence that he wasn't going to hit back, he wasn't going to fight back. Also, there was a practical calculation here. He knew that if he fought back, he'd probably be attacked by 48 boys, so it wasn't going to pay off anyway. But what he did was just stray out of the Bible. He did. He dropped his arms, and he said, "I love you, Thomas." And Thomas did not know what to do. It was like nonviolence disarmed him.
And it was interesting. He took so much abuse in high school that the founder of Koinonia, Clarence Jordan, who absolutely preached nonviolence. He preached at Martin Luther King's church. He was a fairly famous religious figure in race relations and the sort of ideal Christian community he created. He actually said, "You know, maybe you should defend yourself."
Clarence Jordan is a really great figure. One of the problems I had in writing this book was I loved Clarence so much, and I loved the history of Koinonia so much, and I loved the history of the civil rights movement in southwest Georgia so much, that I kept wanting to go into more and more about them and had to keep reminding myself to focus in on my story of Greg and his classmates. Clarence was a great believer in nonviolence. He was a very funny, folksy guy. He's very well known for writing these books called the Cotton Patch Translations of the New Testament. He translated the New Testament into the Southern vernacular. So, you know, instead of having King Herod, you would have Governor Talmadge in Atlanta and that sort of thing. Clarence saw Greg come home from school one day with this, what appeared to be blood all over his shirt. And what it actually was somebody had thrown a sloppy Joe at him in the cafeteria that day and hit him. And Greg had left the stain on his shirt because he wanted to show everybody at school what he was going through. I mean, he was quite literally wearing a, well, not literally, but he was wearing a bloody shirt. That was, you know, you've heard that expression. Well, Clarence saw him coming home from school, thought it was blood. Then when he saw it wasn't blood, he came up and gave him a big hug. And a few days later, pulled him aside and said, you know, Greg, this nonviolence stuff, maybe it's really more for adults. Maybe, you know, you're a strong guy. I've seen you working on the farm. I know you got muscles. Maybe if one of these guys, you know, somebody your size or bigger actually, you know, challenges you to a fight someday, maybe you ought to just haul off and whoop his ass. Maybe that'd stop it. And Greg was astonished because this was kind of like, this would have been like Gandhi telling you to have mix it up. and Greg actually, he thought about it, and he knew that he could beat up most of those people, but he just thought, well, you know, I'm already in this with one foot. I might as well go in with both feet. This is what I believe in, and this is what we're going to do.
Earlier you were saying you really were attached to telling the larger history, which you do in the class of 65. Tell us a little bit about Koinonia. It was a really amazing community, and people will know Koinonia, the byproduct of Koinonia, because eventually in the 70s, I think it was, Millard and Linda Fuller came to Koinonia, and of course that's Habitat for Humanity today. It started at Koinonia.
The Fullers came to Koinonia actually the year Greg graduated from high school in 1965. And they were having a crisis in their marriage and in their lives, and they were looking for a way to sort of rededicate their lives to the religious faith that they'd grown up with. And they really hit it off with Clarence. And they went off and did some other things for a while, but they came back and lived at Koinonia in the late 60s. And the idea of building housing pretty much at cost for working poor people started at Koinonia. They originally called it the Fund for Humanity. And then after Clarence died in 1969, Millard became the head of Koinonia, and he sort of refined the notion there, and by the mid-70s founded what, you know, Habitat for Humanity. So Koinonia has a halo around its head as far as people in Sumter County are concerned now, because it has this connection to Habitat. But it certainly didn't when Greg was growing up there in the 50s and the early 60s.
Well before the civil rights era began, the Klan probably focused as much on Koinonia as it did on any other aspect of race relations, didn't it?
It did, but it actually is kind of wrapped up in the civil rights movement. What happened was Koinonia was founded down there in 42, and people always were suspicious of it, but they mostly tolerated it. They knew that they had this funny thing about wanting to eat with black people and live with black people, but as long as they kept it on the farm, they were okay with it. It was like having a nudist colony in the county or something. What changed all that was the Supreme Court's decision on school desegregation in 1954. Not long after that decision, Clarence went to Atlanta and endorsed two black students who were trying to desegregate what is now Georgia State University. And by the time he got home, it was on the front page of the America's newspaper that a local clergyman wanted to desegregate the state's beloved university system. And from that very week, there started to be vandalism. It escalated. For about 2 years, it was violence against Koinonia. There were drive-by shootings. Greg was out playing volleyball one night in early 1957 when some Klansmen came by and shot at them. There was a serious assassination attempt on Clarence Jordan at his house one night. Their farm market out on U.S. 19 was blown up twice. A feed and seed store in Americas that was selling stuff to them, they were boycotted pretty much by all the local businesses. And there was a seed store that sold to them for a while, and they were bombed. They were dynamited in downtown Americas. People went out and tried to buy them out. I mean, Greg was in the third and fourth grade, and he was getting shot at, and he was seeing their property being bombed. And so by the time he got to high school, he had already had an advanced education in nonviolence.
And of course, at that point, as Americas is getting ready to desegregate their schools, Americas does play a role in the civil rights struggle. In fact, it was front page news, the struggles in Albany and Americas. But it's funny that most of that story of the civil rights movement has faded. In fact, it was really interesting to read that, like, Martin Luther King was there and jailed. Hosea Williams had a special place in his heart for Americas. He really hated the white authority figures in Americas.
Hosea Williams was Martin Luther King Jr.'s, one of his main lieutenants at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Hosea was coming back. He served in the Army in World War II under Patton in Europe. And when he was coming home in 1945, he was riding a bus back to his little town where he was from near the Florida line. And he stopped at in Americus, and he drank out of a water fountain that wasn't marked colored. And some people got mad at him, and even though he was wearing his uniform, he was beaten nearly to death. He spent several weeks in the hospital. So when he heard that there were protests going on in Americus, he was all too happy to join that. What happened was the civil rights movement came to Southwest Georgia in 1961, these mass protests in Albany. It's actually a little understood part of the movement. It was the first mass protest against segregation really in any city in America, and it was the first place where hundreds of folks were being arrested for rising up and protesting Jim Crow. And that movement spread to the towns around there, and the first town it spread to was Americus, which is about 35 miles up the road from Albany. So at the time Greg was going through high school, you started having, in the summer of 63, there were all these mass protests against segregation in Americus, and scores of young black people and a few white activists are being thrown into jail. And pretty much in 63, 64, and 65, there was really ugly stuff going on in Americus. And, you know, the civil rights movement's kind of like the Civil War. There were scores and scores of battles all over the place, confrontations everywhere, but we remember just a handful of them. We remember Selma and Birmingham and Montgomery and just a handful of them, the same way that the Civil War to us is sort of like Antietam and Gettysburg and Vicksburg and Atlanta and just a handful of datelines. Well, Americus is one of the most significant datelines in the civil rights movement that most people have never heard of. The summer that Greg graduated from high school in 1965, it was actually, there were massive voting rights protests in Americus. It was in many ways the closing chapter of the voting rights struggle that opened in Selma earlier that year.
Yeah, basically, I think blacks were being allowed to vote, although they were being harassed, but there were three lines. There was white men, white women, and blacks.
Well, yeah, in the summer of 65, in July of 65, they had it was a very obscure election. It was a special election for justice of the peace, I think. And this was a year after the Civil Rights Act had passed, and one of the candidates was a black woman. And when she came to vote, they showed her to the black voting line, which theoretically should have been illegal for about a year. But as we know, those laws take a long time to sort of take hold. And she was arrested. And that's what caused all the protests in Americus. There were about 3 weeks in July and early August, which coincidentally were the same time that the Voting Rights Act was in the balance in the Congress in Washington. And all the civil rights organizations sent their organizers down to Americus and got involved in these protests because they very much saw this as a way to clinch the voting rights bill in Congress. They needed one more example of white people behaving badly in the South to show the nation that, you know, we're not kidding here. This is actually needed.
My guest today is Jim Akmuti. His new book is The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and the Long Road to Forgiveness. It tells the story of Greg Whitcamper and the Koinonia religious commune, its role in the civil rights struggle, which was a major role. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Greg was certainly very much involved in that civil rights struggle, and Koinonia was sort of ground zero for organizers, sort of a respite, if you will, a place where they felt safe to plan their protest. But after high school, after that summer, Greg left Americus. He was booed literally as he went across the stage on the graduation exercise.
Well, we should talk about his graduation a minute, because that was 50 years ago this month, the first Monday in June, 1965. And Greg was indeed booed when his name was called to collect his diploma. And then more than that, he came to the graduation ceremony with probably his best friend at the time, who was a black man, Collins McGee, 2 or 3 years older than Greg, who worked at Koinonia. And Collins was a veteran civil rights activist, had already been arrested and been involved in a lot of the protests. And he came to the graduation ceremony with Greg. And when they left the gymnasium, which is where the ceremony happened that night because there was a good chance of rain, they were chased off campus by a group of about 20 white men who were throwing things at them and screaming things at them, and one guy came up and hit Collins over the head with an umbrella. It was a perfect bookend to the way the school year began, a very similar scene, you know. But there was also something that happened at that graduation that promised better things to come. Before the ceremony began, one of Greg's white classmates, a fellow named David Morgan, who had become increasingly uncomfortable by the way Greg was being mistreated by everybody, he walked up to Greg in front of all the students and shook his hand and congratulated him and said, "I don't know how you made it." And it was just by far the nicest gesture any of his white classmates had ever made to him. And by coincidence, 40 years later, David was the classmate who was planning their 40th reunion. He was the guy who was in charge of planning that thing. And he's the one who floated the idea with several of the other classmates who he knew were good people and had sort of not said anything while that was going on in high school. He said, "Do you ever think about Greg? I think we need to reach out to him and find him and let him know how awful we feel about what happened and ask for his forgiveness." And as it turned out, there were a whole group of them who felt that way.
Hmm. You know, at this point, this is 40 years later. Greg has gone on with his life. He traveled the world for a number of years, saw most of the world, had moved beyond it, and really, given all the abuse he took, and this was, he was probably singular among the Koinonia kids, he'd moved on beyond it for the most part.
Well, Greg, after high school, Greg had been had gone off to college with this very interesting sort of experimental college program that the Quakers did called Friends World College. And they literally did send him around the world to four continents to do a comparative study of religions. So he really cleansed his soul of what had happened to him in high school. He had some nightmares. He had some post-traumatic stress, for sure. But he was able to move on. And by the mid-70s, he and a handful of other people who had grown up at Koinonia during those years had settled in West Virginia, in southern West Virginia, not too far from the Greenbrier Resort, beautiful part of the world. So when this 40th reunion was coming up, David Morgan and these other classmates, they didn't know where to find Greg. They hadn't heard from him in years. He certainly hadn't been invited to any of their other reunions. And they got in touch with an English teacher of theirs who had been very sympathetic to Greg in high school. And as it turned out, she had kept in touch with Greg's mother, and they had gone to the same church for a while in Americus. And she, you know, let him know where Greg was in West Virginia and what his address was. And these classmates orchestrated a letter-writing campaign. There were about 10 of them who wrote these letters to Greg that he received within 2 or 3 days of each other. And he had literally never heard from these people in 40 years. And then all of a sudden he gets all these an invitation to his class reunion and all of these letters that are really quite beautiful. Have I got a minute just to read from the beginning of one of the letters?
Yes, that'd be great.
This is a letter that David sent. This was actually the first. Greg went to his post office box in Sinks Grove, West Virginia, to check his mail, and he found this invitation to his reunion, which floored him. And then the next thing was a letter from David Morgan, who was a name he recognized. He thought, "Oh, gosh, what is this? How do they even know I live here?" And the letter began, "Dear Greg, I expect you will be quite surprised to hear from me. If you remember me at all, it will likely be for unpleasant reasons. I was a classmate of yours at Americus High School and graduated with you in 1965. I don't recall ever directly assaulting you, but I probably did, to gain the acceptance and accolades of my peers. In any case, I surely participated as part of an enabling audience and tacitly supported and encouraged those who did. For that, I'm deeply sorry and regretful. Throughout the last 40-plus years, I have occasionally thought of you in those dark days that you endured at our hands. As I matured, I became more and more ashamed and wished that I had taken a different stand back then. I knew even then that it was all wrong, yet I did nothing to stop it or even to discourage it." And the letter went on for some time, and it's a very beautiful letter, and it wasn't the only one. There were several others.
And as a result, Greg accepted an invitation to return. It wasn't a complete closure, but it was pretty good, I would say.
Well, yeah, and, you know, what I would say is at least a third of this book actually has to do with how his classmates changed. I follow four of them who wrote letters to him, and they were children of segregation. They're all 8 years older than I am, and they grew up in Americus, and they were raised in one world, and when they were in the middle of high school, that world changed utterly. And, at, you know, think about that. That's an awfully enormous adjustment to have to make. And all four of these students went out, and, you know, the guys were in the military, they went to college, they moved away, they broadened their horizons and they broadened their minds, and like so much of America, they had to change their hearts or they weren't going to be happy people in the new world. And they did. And I think these letters are really evidence of that. And I'm pleased with this aspect of the story because I don't think in lots of tellings of the civil rights movement, most tellings of the civil rights movement focus very rightfully so on the courage of the particularly the black protesters who stood up and insisted on their rights. But there are two sides to this equation, which Martin Luther King Jr. understood very well. You have to change the hearts of the people who are either oppressing or are part or standing by while other people are oppressing. And I think this story speaks very much to the kind of transition that a lot of people had to make to make this a better country. Nothing good ever happens unless you change individual minds and hearts. That's the basic building block of changing society. People have to broaden their minds. People have also asked me when I've done talks and all, they've asked me, you know, haven't we solved all this? Doesn't this show that, you know, isn't this as far as people need to go on this? And you know, the answer is no, because there's always residual attitudes, there's always residual prejudice. And every time in this country we think that we've got this race thing solved, there always comes up an issue that reminds us that we don't. And all of these police confrontations in the last couple of years are the issue that we're all thinking about right now. They're all individual cases. In some cases, the police behaved badly. In some cases, the police, I think, were probably justified because they were being threatened, and they did need to do something. But the more interesting thing to me is the way everybody reacts to it. It should be obvious to anybody that there's a great deal of anger, particularly in the black community, about the policing of their communities. And when you see something like that, you know that maybe the glass is three-quarters full, but it's still one-quarter empty, and we still got a way to go.
Well, it's a really interesting book, The Class of 65. Jim Ockmoody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. This has been a good discussion. I've enjoyed it.
Jim Ockmoody is a former reporter and editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the author of The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. It's published by Public Affairs. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.